My name is Lanny Peterson, and I am so delighted tonight to welcome Regina Carpenter, also known as Reg and Reggie, who is going to share with us her wisdom and experience in the world of healing story. So I'm just going to turn it right over to you, Regina, and we're excited to enjoy the next hour in your company.
Oh, well, the pleasure is mine, too. So thanks to everybody who tuned in, and thanks to NSN and HSA, and to you, Lanny, for suggesting this teleconference. So tonight I want to talk to you about a storytelling initiative called Stories with Spirit, which was designed, is being designed to provide comfort, joy, and hope for grieving and ill children and the people who love and care for them. So I would love to start tonight with a song that you'll hear throughout the presentation as a way of transitioning and also to sort of bring us right into the heart of Stories with Spirit. I've got a million nightingales on the branches of my heart. I've got a million nightingales on the branches of my heart, singing freedom, 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 singing freedom, freedom, freedom. I've got a million nightingales on the branches of my heart. Stories with Spirit is a very simple act of love. It's really a simple act of love from a storyteller to a story listener. So tonight, in an effort for me to be all for you, I want to walk you through the evolution of Stories with Spirit and the questions I had to ask along the way and the answers that I came to in order to craft stories for this particular group of children and their families, and to use stories and songs to answer the needs of grieving and ill children. How does that sound?
Great.
Can everyone still hear? Oh, you're on mute. Oh, sorry. So, how did this begin? Well, it started with a story a few years before it ever began. In 2006, my brother Tim was killed in a car accident. And I knew the way that I could feel better was to tell stories to other people. So I called up my local hospice, and I offered to tell stories to the children there. They have a program called the Good Grief Program, which is all around the United States for children who have lost someone significant in their lives. And for one day, the kids get together and they play and they listen to stories and they do activities that help them process their grief. So when I was preparing to go, I have to tell you that I was really feeling a little bit of anxiety because I wasn't really sure what I was supposed to be doing. I wasn't really sure if I was supposed to tell stories about death. Was I supposed to avoid stories about death? Was I supposed to just make them laugh? Was I distraction? I really had no idea. I couldn't figure it out. And also what I didn't understand at that point was that having just experienced a loss of my own, I was experiencing some hesitation around talking about death openly. So commingling with my own feelings was a sense of responsibility and confusion about what best to do for the kids. So as we go on, I would like us all to kind of contribute to this part as storytellers. And if you could take your mute buttons off, I would love to hear now What kinds of questions, if you were in this position that I found myself in, what kind of questions might you begin to ask yourself in order to clarify what your role would be? Any ideas? I hear a lot of clicking.
I don't. Can anybody hear me? I don't know if I'm on mute or not.
Yep. Nope. You're here.
Okay. Hi. This is Bob Kanigas with Liz in New Mexico. So just the first question that came up for me is how soon is it? Not that there's an answer to this, but how soon is it appropriate to tell humorous stories and to be able to laugh again?
Yeah, I was wondering about that too.
And does anybody know how I mute the phone so now I can mute to listen?
You can just leave it on. Go ahead, and then you can respond. Does anybody else have any questions? Like, how would you go about trying to shape a program? What questions might you ask?
Your questions were great, great ones.
This is Lanny.
I'm
just thinking of the difficulties of knowing the range of children who are there and therefore developmentally where they are in understanding deaf and their situation and how much magical thinking still at play for some and not for others, and for how much they even understand the finality of it, and many younger ones certainly don't. And when you're working with that broad spectrum, that can be tricky to know where to enter.
Yeah, that was my concern too.
This is Noah. One question that comes to my mind if I had to work with kids like this, how direct can I be or should I be? I mean, how much do I need to let them lead the way into what they're comfortable in talking about? And where is it appropriate to help them come out? And how do I do that?
Are parents going to be in the room or not? Another question to ask is that, the parents often have less comfort than the kids do with certain topics.
Well, I knew the answer to that, Lenny, because Good Grief is just for children.
Great.
The parents don't come.
Mm-hmm.
All of those questions were going through my mind as well. And because I didn't really know anything at that point, I decided that I would focus on a joyful experience with them. I knew I wasn't a social worker. I knew I wasn't an expert in this. But I knew that I did know how to tell stories, and I did know how to connect to them joyfully. So that's what I did. And it worked, and it was wonderful. But something was bothering me. I kept thinking I could have offered them something more. And in retrospect, I look at this very first experience as one where a storyteller is invited to tell stories at a wedding and doesn't tell a love story, you know, kind of missing the main point. There's all kinds of love stories, right? And there's all kinds of ways I could have considered bringing up a sense of loss and a sense of renewal. But I just wasn't skilled enough, nor did I feel confident enough to try it. So I went away from that experience, and very shortly after that, I had another one. But this time it was at the same hospice, but this time it was for families. And we met in the great room, and I decided that this time I would try to tell a story about unconditional love between a parent and a child, where the parent, the child is taken from the parent, and the parent, I mean, you know, these are all the great stories, right? And the parent doesn't rest until they get the child back. And while I was telling that story, something began to happen. There was that feeling of calm. There was that quietness that we recognize that comes into the room when the story is right and the audience is right and the time is right. And I began to see that the people listening to the story, their faces were changing, their bodies were calming, they were leaning into one another, they had formed a group, and the story was bringing us all together and connecting us into something that was stronger than this fear of loss or pain. And that was the moment I began to see, oh, something is happening here. And I went from telling stories to a group of children to telling stories for them. So then I went home, and this is all, you know, this, when I look back on these events, they seem sort of destined in a way, but of course at the time I wasn't aware of it. I just was driven by this desire, really, to share the thing that I knew had helped me with people that I saw also needed help. So I went home one day, and my message machine was blinking. And so I got this. This was the message on my message machine. I said, hi, my name is Garble Garble, and I was wondering if you would go to Garble Garble Hospital and tell stories to a little girl named Garble Garble. And my phone number is Garble Garble. I'll pay for your gas. What? I mean, I didn't even have caller ID, so I couldn't call this person back, and I must have played that message about 50 times. I couldn't figure out what they were saying, what their name was. The only thing I could understand was, go tell stories at a hospital for a little girl, right? Now, most of you guys know I'm Catholic, so I thought, oh my gosh, if I don't go to some hospital to tell stories to a little girl, I'm going to fry in hell. I've got to go. So I called the nearest children's hospital, which is in Syracuse, because I live in Ithaca, New York, and I set up a date with a really appreciative social worker. And she said, you know, come at this on this day at this time, and you can tell stories to the kids. And I was just hoping that this child was there and that I had chosen the right hospital. So when I arrived, the social worker told me that the children were too ill for me to for them to come to the common room, and would I be willing to go from bed to bed? Of course. I said, of course. And this was the experience that really set this whole thing, I think, firmly in its own direction. So I began moving in the ward. And if you haven't been to a pediatric hospital ward, pediatrics have children there from, I think the youngest is 3, but I could be wrong about that, 2 or 3 years old, up to the age of 19. So the social worker took me to the first bed, and I saw a little boy whose parents were sitting next to him. He had been in the hospital for many months, and he was watching television. When he wasn't watching television, he was watching a Disney movie. And his parents were sitting next to him, and they had been taking turns staying with the boy since he was admitted. And his parents looked exhausted and completely bored. And so I was watching the parents, I was watching the child, and I saw that even though they were next to one another, they were very isolated from one another. And so I started searching through my stories, and I started wondering, well, what can I tell? Do I tell a story for the parents? Do I tell a story just for the child? How can I meet both of their needs? So again, I want to pause now here and ask you to unmute your phones and see if you are in this situation, how might you figure out, you know, or ascertain what kinds of stories you could tell to breach that gap for the parent and the child? What might you guys respond? That wasn't even a sentence. What might you respond with? Preposition. No one? Is anybody there?
We're all here. It's a big question.
It's huge, I know.
Yeah. I just off the top of my head, something that would even be interactive to get them all involved.
Yeah, that's what I came up with too. Yeah. Well, the first thing that I did, does anybody else have a response? So, you know, I think of this type of telling as guerrilla telling, G-U-E-R-I-R-R-I, can't spell it, but you know what I mean? Because it's the kind of telling that you can't really go in completely prepared because you don't know what the need is. So my first thing was I was thinking of looking at a child who had been inside now for months at a time. And so I wanted to connect the child with childhood, with being outside, with images of nature, with being reminded that that they can get well, that they will be strong again, that there are people, they have pets and siblings who are looking forward to seeing them, and that they can remember being at home, and they can remember food and the joy of eating, because many children in the hospital become so sick that they are fed by feeding tubes. And I also wanted to remind the parents that they could have an intact family again. And even though those things may not happen right away, they could happen in the story. So I saw the story as being a way of delivering images that naturalize or remind the child of what it's like to be well at home with people who love them. And so I went back to the standard repertoire, you know, the standard repertoire of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the standard repertoire of the Gunny Wolf, the standard repertoire of the very simple, the Three Billy Goats Gruff, where the parents got to say the refrain. And in those stories, of course, there is a sense of the small hero or of a hero, right, where that vanquishes over the fear. And so that's where I started. And I did that at that bed, and I did it at the next bed and the next bed. But it wasn't until the fourth bed that that a more difficult question hit me. At the fourth bed, I encountered a boy who was probably about 12 years old. Now, it gets hard to understand because many of the children, when they're ill like that, they haven't grown, so it's hard to guess their age. They may their chronological age, but it's also sometimes hard to guess their developmental age. But he was about 12, and sitting next to him was his 17-year-old brother, who had been there all week. And the boy had a moon-shaped face from steroids, from having had steroids. Half of his body and face were paralyzed from a stroke, and he had this very large U-shaped scar on his shaved head. He couldn't speak. He had many, many tubes coming out from all over his body. But this is really kind of delightful and was unexpected. He was eating cookies. And he was really enjoying the cookies. I mean, he was like shoving the cookies into his face and then sort of like letting the drool dissolve the cookies, and then he would swallow them. And he was loving the cookies. And I want to mention here that the children don't feel self-pity, okay? I felt pity for him, but he was not involved in self-pity. He was just really loving these cookies. So I told him David Novak's story, The Cookie Girl, but I couldn't tell if he liked it or not. So I asked his brother, did he enjoy that story? And his brother said, yeah, he loved it. So I said, well, how did you know? And the brother said, well, he's blinking a lot. That means he likes it. I'm sure he would like another story. So, I wanted to, again, take a pause here at this juncture and allow you to make any comments now that little new piece of the puzzle may have brought up for you. Does anybody have any comments about that?
I think of, this is Lanny again, I think of the storyteller as being in relationship with the listener and taking their cues and evolving the story within the relationship with the other person. And when the other person is not able to give any cues back, how much more that puts on you as the teller to know where to go and how to take it. It's
mm-hmm.
huge.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Any other thoughts?
Maybe it's a little like this conference call when you're talking and you can't see our faces or hear our responses.
Yeah, it's very weird, yeah.
I was thinking
very
about
weird.
That.
It's very hard for me because I really enjoy interaction and surprises, you know. Yeah, you wonder if it's telling into a void, right?
Right.
And then the question is, if there is no response, is it of value?
Right.
Right? Or if you can't interpret the response, how do you know what to do?
That it's worthless, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's really big, right? That's a big, big question.
Mm-hmm.
And this young man actually was an enormous turning point for me. Because he was really, once I started to watch him, and watch his physical response to the story, and to my telling, I became, I think, in that real moment, a real storyteller. Because I wasn't hoping he was responding to me. I was completely for him.
Mm.
And I watched his respiration, and I began to match his rate of breathing with my, you know, my rate of breathing to his. I stilled my body, you know. I moved it so that because of his stroke, I had to make adjustments so that he could really see me, because he couldn't move in case I moved too much. And I created that kind of invisible cord that certainly we understand when we have our infant children, we understand that. But I created this invisible cord between myself and him. And the cord was built with the story. I can't even remember what I told him after that, but I know I just stayed there because his brother kept saying, oh, he loves it. And slowly I started to see that the way he laughed was by going, pushing breath out of his mouth. And his one hand that was working, it would start to twitch. And I could see that he was enjoying the story. So at this point, in my own evolution, I began to see that my job really was to be all for the listener, to completely be there for the listener and for their experience. So that was the very first juncture of Stories with Spirit. Any comments or thoughts?
Very inspiring.
Oh, well, thank you.
I think that's what you're doing for us.
Oh.
That you're there for us. And we're so completely, and we're so completely in train with your telling, your experience, that we absorb it. And that's what you're hearing in the silence.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's breathe together. I've got a million nightingales on the branches of my heart. So at this point, I'd like to bring up a question that many people ask me, and that is, how do you prepare yourself to go to the hospital or to tell to such ill children or to go to the hospice and work with a dying child? And they use a word that we're all very accustomed to. They often say, how do you protect yourself when you go into this work? And just as Stories with Spirit, the concept has developed, so has my own understanding of my role within it. And if you recall, when I went to Good Grief that very first time, I really wasn't aware of, I was afraid of death, and I would say, if push came to shove, I probably would have to say that I am still afraid of death. I've become much more comfortable with it, but I'm in no rush, you know. So when I've had to spend quite a lot of time thinking about this and getting right is what I like to call it. So when I am preparing to go into one of the larger hospitals and being with very ill children, I really focus on the reality that the child that I'm telling to isn't dead. In fact, they are far from dead. They are as alive as they can be, and they want to experience life. So I keep telling myself, you know, it ain't over till the fat lady sings, right? And I focus on life, and more importantly for me, I focus on my absolute faith in the power of story. And that when I am with the child and the story comes to me, or I'm creating the story, as I'll talk about in a little bit, that it is the right story and it's the right medicine to remind us of this experience we're calling life in all of its colors. So rather than contracting or protecting myself or trying to ward off anything, I actually focus on expanding and expanding into an absolutely indomitable spirit of life. I feel that's my responsibility as a storyteller and just as a human being in general to be aware of the joyfulness of life, even at times when it's pretty tough. So that's, I just want to make sure I talked a little bit about that. Any thoughts? It's okay if there's not.
Sounds admirable, Reggie.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
We're just listening in awe.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, there's many different expressions of the work right now, as there are environments, right? I want to talk a little bit about the hospital environment. So when you're telling at a hospice, it's a very traditional telling environment. You know, there's a separation between the teller and the children, or the teller and the families. But in the hospital, it's a very difficult environment. It's very noisy. There's a lot. The children, you know, they're isolated in their rooms, or they're in a common room, but there's a lot of people around them, and they're by their side is usually their parent, and the parent, again, has been with the child for a long time, and the parent is in this limbo state. So, you know, they're not sick, but they're with the child. They can't really go home. Their life is just very much on hold in a lot of ways. And so, and often the children themselves have. I was unfamiliar with this until I started going, but they have many, many tubes coming out of their bodies. They have tubes going down their noses that are feeding them. They have IV tubes. They have bags on them. They can look really quite disturbing. You know, it's hard to be prepared for that. But what I was thinking a lot about, and whenever I think about this, I think about what is the need and how can the story be a benefit to the need? How can the story serve the need? And so I started thinking, you know, all those wonderful stories that you tell children using their fingers and their hands. I mean, little finger stories, and Jim May's wonderful Mr. Wiggle and Mr. Waggle, and all the Johnny Whoop stories, and here's the baby story, the Ann Pulowski stories, all those wonderful, wonderful stories you tell using the hand. And I thought, oh, what if I could tell stories that use pieces of paper, that if I showed the parent they could then do with the child when I'm gone. Pieces of paper that can be folded, stories that are drawn. You remember all those great stories where you're drawing and you're telling a story and at the end of it there's a picture of something that you don't see until the very end. Little stories that you tell with your fingers. And I thought, this would be a great way to lessen the isolation of the parent and the child. It would be a way for the child to have touch that isn't harmful to them, that feels really, you know, sweet and kind of tingly. And that also can calm their nervous system. And it also gives the parents something to do with the child rather than just sitting and watching the television, which I have to say is almost an exclusive thing that I see the children doing when they're in the hospital. And it really, I know that they love it, but to me, there's something that could be more nourishing for them. So I thought, well, maybe I could go in with this, and I call this my big bag of fun. And I just have little pieces of paper and golf pencils, and I just teach stories to the parent that they can do with the child later on when I'm gone. So I would love to hear from you guys of any little stories, because I'm always on the lookout, of any little stories that you can think of right now that might fit into that bill of origami stories or drawn stories or little finger stories. If you want to just share those, then we can all have something in common with one another. Any thoughts? Hey. Wow, I feel like Nixon's secretary.
Reggie, this is Jane, and I'm unmuting. My dogs are barking in the background, so that's why I've been on mute so much. But, you know, there are a lot of collections probably in anyone's public library or your own library, like Ring of Roses, that was put out by a library in Flint, Michigan, that has a lot of finger plays. Any teacher supply store will have like the mailbox for different ages where you can get that. And, of course, there's so many now online that you can search for.
Oh, yes,
Karen. Yeah, Karen Chase has an excellent bibliography on her site. I think Megan Hicks has done some origami stories on YouTube, actually.
Yeah, so she's brilliant, isn't she?
There are a lot that are out there. And I just think that's a brilliant idea, what you're saying, to find something that the parents can share, too, especially the finger plays, because since so many of the touches the kids are getting are helpful touches, but there's still touches that can hurt, to add an element of joy and fun. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah. Jane, have you used any of those in your own work that you could share with us?
I have not gone into any hospitals or any healing centers that way. When I was working as a librarian, which I'm no longer doing, workforce reduction, which may be a good thing. I did, you know, preschool story hours, so there were always, you know, little finger plays that I would work in and try to teach the parents. I always started with my favorite of, you know, five little monkeys jumping on the bed, that would be my signature thing to start out, and I'd blend in a little family story to sort of get that across, why monkeys were important to me. But I found in those story times there were often children. There was one group, the Spiritus School, that came that dealt primarily with an autistic audience, and I was so pleased over the course of a season, or I'm thinking semesters, but over the course of the story time sessions, how the kids came out. that I gave, you know, I tried to give that freedom to come out and yes, and, you know, yes, thank you, Noah, that's wonderful, and that how they became comfortable with the repetition of something they knew, so even those who were facing challenges could participate.
I think you brought up a really wonderful point that children who are in the hospital who are that ill, their bodies are a source of pain, you know. And what's so nice about the finger play is that they can remember that they can move parts of their body and have it be really fun, you know, and you know, a child, even when they're very, very ill, they're still a kid. They still like to have fun, and part of my mission, of course, is that for all children is that that you don't have to have you don't have to spend money to have fun, that your creativity is an endless source of free fun. And so thank you for that, Jane. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. And something that just came through as you were saying that and thinking about the fun is you could actually, even with the corner of the sheet, not to say tear it up, but, you know, put your hands around it and make a little puppet that way. So that they're in bed with sheets. The sheets will be there when you leave. And that's something that they could, you know, just have fun and play with. And their parents could too. So, well, thank you for planting the seeds that allowed that to come through.
Cool. Oh, you're a genius. A genius, I say.
No, thank you. I just try to be a channel for the brilliant. I don't blame it as myself. I just try not to get in the way.
Does anybody else have anything they'd like to share around this? No, not yet. Okay. Well, let's move on then to, I'm going to talk about one other little thing, not so little, actually. And then I thought I would tell you a story and then we could all go home or get out of the car. So I want to tell you an experience that I had of absolute failure when I was in the hospital, and that led to another discovery. So I got a phone call one day. As you know, I'm getting a lot of phone calls. And it was a woman named Dixie Brown from Memphis, Tennessee. And she said she had heard about Stories with Spirit and that her storytelling guild wanted to bring me down. And if they brought me down, would I go to St. Jude and the Bonner Children's Hospital? So this was very exciting for me, and I was very appreciative. And when I got there at St. Jude is just a beautiful facility, very, very quiet, but I wasn't able to see any children. None of them were available when I was there. So I had made an appointment. You always have to make an appointment when you go into the hospital. I had made an appointment to go to the other hospital, Le Bonheur. And Le Bonheur is very different from St. Jude. It's kind of more of a city hospital. It was very noisy. It was very crowded. It was very crazy. There was just a lot of conversation. and they put me in the corner by, and all you storytellers are going to love this one, by the escalator where the workmen were installing a new ceiling, and there was a bunch of stuff stored in the other corner. So, you know, I felt like, oh, wow, all I need now is some tap dancing duo, and this will be complete. So all these kids show up, right? Tons of kids are showing up. And I'm enjoying myself. I'm telling stories, and I'm having fun. And then there's this little break, and the kids are having fun, and I'm seeing that, oh, yeah, this is working pretty well. And then this one boy came who was clearly, you know, not doing well. And he couldn't, I asked him if he wanted a chair. He said he couldn't sit because he had too many tumors on his back. And he couldn't eat because the medicine had caused his stomach to have ulcers. And he was very ill and very unhappy. And so I said, well, I'd love to tell you a story. What kind of story would you like to hear? What do you like? And he said, well, I like stories about wizards. And right then, I felt kind of sick because I don't know any stories about wizards. And because I was bound to telling only stories that I knew, I did not have a story for this boy. And I feel really very bad about that. And I tried to sort of fake my way through it, and it wasn't working. And, you know, I realized that this boy had come all the way down from his room and to stand against a wall to listen to a not very good story and then go back up. And that led me to think, how could I create a story? How could I unbind myself from only telling stories that I know? How could I create a story that fills the need of the child, you know, right there? How could I do that? So I went back and I want to give credit to Nancy Mellon. I'm not sure if Nancy's still here, but...
yes, I'm here.
Yes. Oh, she has the best story structure. And I think it's your storytelling, your first book, Nancy. It's just so wonderful. And... do I have that right? It's in your...
Storytelling in the Art of Imagination.
Yes. Oh, it's a fabulous book. And I'm sorry that I couldn't quote the title. And I also looked at Joseph Campbell's story structure for the hero's quest, the hero's journey. And I thought, if I could get information from the child about what they love, then I could follow this story structure of our hero sets out on a quest, right? There's a problem. There's always a problem, right? Like cancer or sickness or loss or something. And then there's always a gift. The hero is successful, brings something back to the world, and re-enters society, a changed person. I mean, that's essentially, I hope I have that right. I think I have that right. And I thought, if I could use that as my model, then I could improvise a story for any child based on what they are interested in hearing. So that's been my newest evolution of Stories with Spirit. And I think one of the more difficult ones for me, because I'm always trying to get it right. And sometimes, you know, there's that adage of don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And so that's the newest part that I've been doing one-on-one with older children to give them a more personal thing, more personal experience at their bedside. So would anyone like to comment on that before I tell a story and say goodnight?
I think that's wonderful, Reggie. This is Jane again. That's just beautiful. Oh, I love it. I love it.
Oh, thank you, Jane.
Oh, thank you for sharing that, because that's really a way to, you know, solve the problem of, oh my gosh, I don't have a lizard story. And it's also a way to engage the child and make them a true co-creator in the story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I love it.
Yeah, and this in that particular story structure, I've also been able to take to centers for grieving children and teach volunteers how to co-create the story with the children using that structure, so that when the kids are there, they're kind of telling the story. You know, the volunteer is steering the story. Okay, now this is the part where we have to have some kind of boon, right? So what's it going to be? And then the success, and then the celebration at the end. So it's a very nice structure that lends itself to individual telling, but also to creative dramatics. So does anybody else have anything to say around that, or questions about that, or thoughts that I might not have thought of?
This is Lanny again. The last part of the hero's journey is that the hero returns back home and transformed, but the journey isn't complete until they bring their renewed wisdom back to the community to as service. And I'm thinking of you on your hero's journey, and tonight being part of the completion of a circle as you share with us what you've learned from this journey.
Oh, thank you. You know, I hadn't even thought of that.
Sweet. Oh, that's very sweet. I like that.
Oh gosh, I'm getting all teary.
So we have time, Reggie, just for a quick story. It's almost 10, and we'd love to close with that story.
Oh, great. Well, I'll tell it quickly. It's a wonderful story called Gaia. It's a Gaia myth, and I've taken it from from Marilyn McFarland's book, Sacred Myths, Stories of World Religions. So everything started with a song, and as the song was singing itself, it began to create the stars, the moon, the sun, the universe, the black holes. All of these things spun out from the song, which sang its glorious tune out and out, pulsing forth into all of life. It gave forth Gaia, the Great Mother. She spun out and away, rolling and spinning herself into a ball. And as she rolled and spinned, fireballs went past her, and she went from light to dark, from light to dark. And she kept spinning like that through all of creation. Then she stayed in one spot, and spinning in one spot, she stretched her long body, which at this time was flat. She took in a deep breath and exhaled, and clouds formed. Rain began to fall upon her. As the rain touched her body, she started to laugh. Now, some stories of beginnings speak of anger, but not the Gaia story. She laughed, and as she laughed, she put her hands upon her body, and the water sunk into her skin. When she pushed down on her body, there were valleys there, and where there were valleys, next to that, there grew mountains. She put her hands in other places upon her body, and hills grew, caves came. Then the water began to move into those areas and away from others. And in this place, she created waterfalls and lakes, oceans, streams, deserts, and little puddles. And still she laughed, and still she spun from light to dark and light to dark. And as she laughed this time, things began to grow upon her body. There were tarantulas. There were gorillas. There were gargantuan, huge spiders. She laughed snakes into being. She laughed everything into being. And in one huge laugh, she made man and woman. That was the biggest one of all. Gaia, the Great Mother, she allowed the people to live upon her own being. And they walked and explored the plants and the animals and the fresh water. And still Gaia spun from light to dark. And then she decided to give them something that no one could see. She gave them a depth of feeling. She gave them happiness, of course, and wonder. She gave them awe. And then she gave them jealousy and anger. She gave them fear. She gave them sorrow. She gave them grief. And then when their numbers were enough, she brought to them death. And still she spun from light to dark, from light to dark. When there was death within the human family, Gaia took it back into her body, and she breathed, and it rained, and she laughed, and life came. And still, she's spinning from light to dark, from light to dark. She's spinning still.
Regina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes.
This was a gift tonight that you shared with us, your hero's journey and all that you've learned. I've learned a tremendous amount just listening to you, and we can't thank you enough for being here with us. And thank you all for joining us, and please come back again on May 19th when Judith Black will be with us.